Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
Here and now, Iraqis are proudly displaying their ink-stained fingers today to prove that they voted in yesterday's historic election. President Bush is hailing the elections as a vote for democracy. But Sunni Arabs largely did not venture out to vote, a sign perhaps of challenges to come. Joining us first to talk about the election, Borzu Daragahi, a correspondent for the Boston Globe and for Here and Now. He joins us from Baghdad. And Borzu, what is the feeling in Baghdad today, the day after?
It's still a little quiet. You still have a lot of high security precautions around the country. But, you know, we went around and talked to some people in our neighborhood, which is mostly Shia, and, you know, asked them really the crucial question, which is, are you, as a Shia who, you know, basically just won the election, are you prepared to reach a handout to the Sunni Arabs who didn't participate in the election? And to our surprise, the answer was a resounding no. They were saying basically the Sunni Arabs never reached a handout to us when we were the oppressed category in society. So why should we reach a handout to them? If they really wanted a role in the government, they should have participated in the elections. Basically saying tough luck to the Sunni Arabs.
Well, Borzu, is your sense that the Sunnis stayed home in the numbers that they did because they were boycotting or out of fear of the insurgents?
That's a very good point. I think it's both. You know, I think to some extent there was a sense that they were about to be degraded in terms of their social strata. They were about to lose their power and privilege and prestige officially in an election that would secure their status as a minority. But I think also for a lot of people who might have been eager to vote, they were just terrified.
Well, Borzu, you were there when the people in Baghdad did come out to vote. What was it like from your vantage point? What did it feel and look like?
I mean, it was really kind of interesting. In the morning, people were kind of tenuous. They were kind of looking out their windows, seeing what their neighbors were doing. And then eventually people came out and started voting. And really, you know, by, I would say, like mid-afternoon, it was really a festival-like atmosphere in the streets. There were no cars around, so people were playing soccer in the streets and having a good time. And, you know, there was no stores open. People, families were hanging out outside, walking, proudly displaying the ink on their fingers. And, you know, one thing to note is that for Iraqi Shias, they really did have a choice. You know, they had a choice between two very powerful groups, the United Iraqi Alliance, which is led by clerics, and Prime Minister Iyad Alawi's party, which is more secular. So they had a really significant choice, and this was a totally new experience for them.
So it sounds like an unbelievable day, and yet you spoke to a U.S. official today, I know, who had a little bit more of a sober approach to it.
Absolutely. I mean, first of all, U.S. officials are absolutely thrilled by the outcome of the elections, but they were very cautious to warn that the road ahead is long and arduous, that they expect the insurgents, now that they've lost the election, to try to show that they're still around, that they're not going to go silently into that good night. This gentleman, the U.S. diplomat that we had spoken to, was saying that, you know, it's a lot easier to secure sites than it is to fight a morally ambiguous and a militarily challenging insurgency, so that we shouldn't read too much into the fact that there was not as much Election Day violence as anticipated, that the Iraqi security forces still have a long way to go.
Borzu Daragahi, correspondent for the Boston Globe and for Here and Now in Baghdad. Borzu, thanks as always.
It's been a pleasure.
And now to the north, where Abdul Salam al-Madani is a Kurdish election worker in Erbil. We spoke to him on Friday in advance of the elections, and he joins us again. Abdul Salam, hello, and how did it go for you yesterday?
Hello. It was very fine, in fact, and you remember I said that it could be some terrorist actions, but thank God it wasn't so. My expectations was wrong.
Did you vote?
Yeah, sure.
What was it like?
It was a carnival, in fact. I was so proud. I did it for my history, in order to say in that day so many people tried to make us afraid. They tried to make our sound silence, in fact. But we struggled and we across our fears in order to vote and participate in rebuilding our society. We are not going and not allowed to go to the dark ages again.
Mm-hmm. To dark forces, you told us, the dark agents. Never Again the Dark Agents. And we understand also your particular interest was gaining more control of the oil-rich city of Kirkuk. That also drove people to the polls.
Yeah. Maybe you saw it on the TV. They were celebrating on this occasion. Yeah. Not just Kurds. Arab, Kurd, Turkman, everyone.
Abdul Salam, we are reading a U.S. official in Kirkuk was saying that he was concerned that, in fact, too many Kurds might win too many offices and sort of destabilize the balance of power.
This may happen, and it may affect a little bit on the political map or political situation. But all in all, after 9 months, we are going to re-vote. Maybe this will help, and they will do it next time.
Ah, yesterday's vote might encourage more Sunnis and others to come out 9 months down the road.
From my perspective, yes. Mm.
To Crete, Saddam Hussein's hometown, we have heard that some of his family, the Hussein family, actually voted. Do you have any idea what the sense into Crete was?
All in all, the people were afraid, in fact. So I can say that it wasn't that they don't believe in democracy. They were afraid of terrorism. It may kill them.
In other words, they weren't boycotting as much as they were afraid to vote.
I believe next time there is no this kind of threat, the turnout will be more.
Mm. Sorry. Abdul Salam, when we spoke to you on Friday in advance of the elections, we told you shukran aini.
You're welcome. Thanks.
That we would keep you in our heart, in our eye.
Thanks.
Well, we still will, because do you worry that there might still be violence in the aftermath of the election?
There will be, because this kind of mentality, you have some people, and maybe two or three people can make some noise in a city. Mm-hmm. But all in all, this will be ended.
Well, Abdul Salam Medeni, in Erbil, in northern Iraq, an election worker, and thank you.
Thank you. Welcome. Thank you very much.
And now we turn to Dan Murphy of the Christian Science Monitor. He's on the line from Baghdad, but he's just returned from the holy city of Najaf. Dan, what was the scene like in that predominantly Shia city in the south of the country?
You know, I've been in Baghdad for most of the past month, and it was a breath of fresh air. We wandered the streets. We talked with people. Women were out in force, kind of an endless stream of black clouds, because they all wear these huge black abayas down there. And people were proudly displaying their fingers that were marked with ink from the voting. You know, it wasn't quite a carnival. There wasn't dancing in the streets, but, you know, really there was a sort of palpable feeling of joy and delight that there was no violence there. However, when you talk to people sort of in the sober morning light the next day, they do recognize that there are big problems here and they're not going to go away. And they're also expressing some skepticism about their new leaders, even the ones they voted for, about their ability to grapple with Iraq's problems and actually make it a secure place and hopefully a more prosperous place.
What were some of the other things that people said to you about voting, what it meant to them?
Well, you know, in that city in particular, there was a major uprising against Saddam in 1991 that was brutally suppressed. Everybody has a horror story to tell. I mean, it was endless. You know, at one polling station, a young man comes out and he's missing two of his fingers, which he lost in the 1991 uprising, and told about his brother being arrested and executed by the regime. Another family that I sat with said that this history was the first thing on their mind when they got up in the morning to go vote, and they felt like they were voting for, you know, what they call these martyrs in the family.
Hmm. And one last question, Dan. Your sense of how the voting went, the ballot boxes, the security, did it, you know, the monitoring, did it seem to all go smoothly?
You know, I think it was fairly honest and well organized. And, you know, in the evening, you know, people started to count the votes in the polling places by candlelight because, of course, power is very bad. But everything was carried out in a very good spirit. And, you know, I think by and large, it was a pretty fair election.
Dan Murphy speaking to us from Baghdad, having just returned from the holy city of Najaf in Iraq. Dan reports for the Christian Science Monitor. Thanks so much.
Oh, thank you.
Well, now joining us to talk about the future of Iraq is Anthony Cordesman of the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington, D.C. Anthony, what do you make of this? Far less violence than was predicted, far bigger turnout. Can this be sustained, the put down of the insurgency?
Well, one thing we need to be very careful about, until we actually see some numbers on the turnout, we don't have anything. We have some preliminary figures, all of which got disowned.
Mm.
But certainly in Kurdish and Shiite areas, the turnout does seem to have been high. And at least in some Sunni areas, people turned out in spite of what were obviously initial fears. I think it is reassuring to see what's happened. It's a reminder of the fact that while the insurgency is very serious, it is also concentrated among a relative minority of Arab Sunnis who themselves are arguably between 15 and 20% of the population. And in the provinces and areas where the insurgency is most dominant, aside from Mosul, we're talking somewhere between 4 and 6% of the population. The insurgency can, on any given day, perhaps get some major events which get media attention, but it isn't a nationwide popular something that can attack on a broad basis. And I think we saw that in the election, and more than that, we saw what can happen over time as the Iraqi forces come online and can enforce security on a much broader basis than the cadre of U.S. forces in Iraq.
But at any rate, there is going to be an imbalance after yesterday's, you know, overwhelmingly, you know, historic and, as you said, optimistic vote. But there is going to be an imbalance of power, more Kurds voting, more Shia voting. Do you see that leading to problems in the short term?
Well, certainly it isn't going to lead to problems in the short term because the problems are already there. And they've been there for a long time. The fact of the matter is that this was a country governed by a relatively small tribal Sunni minority, which exploited the economy and political system, and now somewhere between 85 and 75% of the population, which is Kurdish, other minorities, and Shiite, is going to dominate the political realities. Sunnis can't ignore that, and certainly the majority can't. Mm-hmm. But so far we have seen the Sunni parties stand aside but not openly reject everything. We have seen the Shiites be inclusive. We haven't seen the Kurds actively press for independence, although they talk about it. Iraqi politicians have been pragmatic and compromising, and they do have the option of both including Sunni ministers in the new government, because they don't have to be members of the National Assembly, and of including them in the constitutional process, and particularly in the drafting, to give them representation. So there really are options that can follow up this election with some very positive developments.
Anthony Cordesman, just a few seconds left. This is a quick day after Reid. We know you're in it for the long haul, but do you see, and we only have about 30 seconds, do you see U.S. troops leaving anytime soon, or is that way off the radar?
I think some troops will phase out. We'll go from 150 to 130,000, more significant phase downs possibly by the end of 2005. And very significant reductions in 2006, if, of course, the elections go well and the Iraqi forces come online.
Anthony Cordesman, analyst on Iraq for the Center for Strategic and International Studies, speaking to us from Washington, D.C. Anthony, back to your tea leaves, and thanks as always.
Thank you.
And when we come back, Iraqi exiles watch on television as their families rejoice back in Baghdad. We'll speak to another voter in Iraq with the help of his son-in-law here in Boston. Stay with us. There's much more ahead, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Well, how did those pictures of Iraqi citizens lining up to vote resonate with Iraqi exiles living in the U.S.? Mudafa Alziadi is an Iraqi living in the Boston area, and we welcome you back, Mudafa.
Absolutely, Robin, anytime.
And we also have Laith Hadi with us, also an Iraqi living in Massachusetts. Laith, welcome. He's in the studio.
Thank you.
And Mudafa, to you first. We spoke to you when the war was just starting, in fact, as bombs fell on Baghdad in the first bombing. Your thoughts of yesterday and the pictures of long lines of Iraqis waiting to vote.
I'm very proud of Iraqis who challenged all the odds, whether it's terrorists or occupation or future identity. I'm very proud of those people who challenge the fear that Saddam Hussein created within all of them and came out by their own choice to deliver their vote.
Yeah. Mudafa, you had a choice to vote. Iraqis, exiles could vote. Did you, and where did you go?
I went to Washington, D.C. I went through the storm, if you remember the blizzard, but I don't consider myself I did something comparing with the courage and the greatness of all Iraqis who came out and vote.
So what was your feeling as you were casting the vote, as you knew fellow Iraqis were doing the same in your homeland?
Well, my feeling, I'm just trying to be connected to them, to share with them. I mean, even though I am not facing the same danger they face, Iraqis are getting rid of the disease Saddam Hussein created within them. That everyone is not responsible for everyone. Now what we have seen yesterday is everyone is responsible for everyone. So all for one and one for all.
Laith Hadi, sitting here in the studio with me, has been nodding his head, right? But Laith, you didn't vote.
No, and I really wanted to vote, and just like Muzaffar said, just to feel connected and just to show support for the people back home. It was logistically for me and my wife, it was hard because I have work and school at night, so that would have had to mean for me to take almost a whole week off to go vote, I mean register and then to go vote.
Yeah, to go down to Washington, D.C.
Right.
Muzaffar, you know, I'm imagining that a lot of Iraqis had that problem. I mean, you know, you were lucky, in fact, that maybe you could go.
Actually, the truth is the type of life we're living in the United States, I mean, could not give us the chance to get, I mean, like a day off or something like that. So we had to do something over our capacity. But as I said before, whatever we do to share the moment with all Iraqis back home, we are doing nothing comparing with the courage those people showed yesterday.
Laith is nodding his head.
I tell you, I mean, I felt goosebumps. I mean, it really felt great. It's a great day for Iraq, great day for the Iraqi people. It's like a challenge against the terrorists.
Muzaffar, have you called family? Have you spoken to family?
Yeah, I did talk to my mother, who is almost 70 years old. She went with my brother and sister.
She probably never thought she was going to do that in her lifetime.
The whole point is not the chance to do it as much as they felt responsible for their future. I mean, please understand me, it's a very important point. It's not a propaganda for George Bush or Tony Blair. I mean, the whole point is doing it for their own sake. And this is whether it's you are educated or very average person, old, young, they all felt if they don't do something, the darkness will stay on. A disease Saddam Hussein create that if something happened to a neighbor, you should stay away from the trouble. But yet, yesterday, no, everyone felt that they are responsible for everyone. And to be honest, I don't like using that greatness of Iraqis for the purpose of political propaganda. Do you understand me, Robin?
Yes, I mean, in other words, you don't want to see this co-opted by American politicians.
No, not just that. I mean, you see the whole history of the current conflict. I mean, whether, I mean, George Bush's strategy was to occupy Iraq. I mean, I didn't believe for once that they went to liberate Iraq. And the fact is, Iraqis are forcing everyone, whether insurgent or occupying power, that the power is in their hands. It's a great day. I mean, not to anyone. It's a great day for Iraqis, just Iraqis.
Muzaffar Alziadi is an Iraqi living in the Boston area. Muzaffar, thanks so much.
Absolutely, Robin, anytime.
And we still have Laith Hadi with us in the studio, also an Iraqi living in Massachusetts. And we want to turn to one of those in Baghdad who made it such a great day yesterday. It's Laith's father-in-law, Muyed Janabi. Mr. Janabi, hello.
Hello.
Mr. Janabi, did you vote?
Yeah, I was there.
And how did that feel to vote?
Believe me, it's very good for us.
Were there a lot of people with you? Was there a crowd going to vote? What was the mood of the people?
We and our neighbors, my wife, my son, lot of us.
Mr. Janabi, by the way, I am sitting here with your son-in-law. Did you know your son-in-law did not vote?
Did not vote. Yeah, that's democratic. It's up of him.
You're saying he has the right not to vote. Laith is right here. I'm wondering if you want to ask your father-in-law anything about the elections.
How did everybody feel? Were they afraid? In the beginning, everybody was afraid, but everybody was walking. It was like a big festival.
Yeah. One last question. Mr. Janabi, 15 to 20,000 Iraqis have died in this war. Were the losses Iraqis have suffered worth it?
Before, how many before they killed?
You're saying Saddam Hussein killed more?
Yeah. How many before they killed? We didn't hurt anybody, and even that they killed also.
I want to thank you both, Mr. Janabi. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Laith, thank you as well.
You're welcome.
Mu'ad Janabi is a citizen of Baghdad. Laith Hadi is an Iraqi living in Massachusetts, and Mr. Janabi is his father-in-law. Earlier, we spoke also to another Iraqi living in Massachusetts from the garage where he works, Mudaffar Al-Ziyadi. Stay with us. There's much more ahead, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And this weekend's historic election in Iraq is being praised around the world. British Prime Minister Tony Blair said he was encouraged by the relatively high turnout. Estimates show about 57% of eligible voters cast ballots. That's roughly 8 million people. And European Union Foreign Minister Javier Solana praised the Iraqi voters for their courage in going to the polls.
I think that shows clearly the will of the Iraqi people to move the country forward in peace and through democratic means. That, I think, is very good news.
But how are the elections being viewed in the region? Joining us on the phone are Bulent Alireza, the Turkey Project Director at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington, D.C. Welcome, Bulent.
Hi.
And from Dubai, Youssef Ibrahim, Managing Director of the Strategic Energy Investment Group and former New York Times and Wall Street Journal correspondent. And Youssef, welcome as always. And I want to start with you. Tell me, hello, and did people watch millions of Iraqis go to the polls? Did they see it?
They saw it all over the place. In fact, it was a showstopper. I passed so many cafes in which the television was on. The coverage by specifically Al Jazeera and the Arab satellites was intense and continuous. And I must say, this was a showstopper. Yeah. I mean, it really brought a lot of surprises. Mostly, it put an end to the whining about Iraq and got a lot of people thinking about this whole thing all over again.
And tell me more about that. Got to put to the end of the whining about Iraq and what nature?
Well,
and
you know, for two years, of course, this adventure or misadventure was ill-advised from the beginning, and we heard nothing but that, and that is correct. But there was another side to this, which appeared on Sunday. I mean, this is going to be a memorable Sunday, which is that Iraqis, eligible voters, 60% almost of them went to the polls. That's very respectable by almost any democratic standard. They went against calls that threatened their lives, which means that something is stirring in there. The Iraqis, despite all the bad conditions they're subjected to, despite the fact that most of them actually resent the American occupation, there is a silver lining in this American occupation, which is it has allowed many Iraqis to come out for the first time in their lives and express their opinion and really find a certain joy in life under something other than Saddam Hussein.
That's Yousef Ibrahim speaking to us from Dubai, the United Arab Emirates. And I want to turn now to Bulent, just to get your quick assessment from Turkey, watching to the south as so many Kurds flocked to the polls. How did Turks view that?
You know, just before the elections, Prime Minister Erdogan, speaking at Davos, said that it was not possible to characterize this election as a fully democratic election. And the reason that he was less than positive about the elections was primarily because of the enhanced position of the Kurds that the elections were certain to bring about.
And we saw these images of Kurds, especially in the oil-rich city of Kirkuk, a city they want more control over. We saw the dancing. We saw the festivities. Is that making people in the region nervous?
And very much so. In fact, Erdogan, Foreign Minister Gül, and interestingly, Deputy Chief of Staff of the Turkish Armed Forces have all talked about the unacceptability of the demographic changes in Kirkuk specifically, that has seen many Kurds come to Kirkuk, the status of which has been disputed, and even threats of possible Turkish intervention in the event of violence between the Kurds and the Turkmens, who are ethnically related to the Turks.
Well, in fact, we know that outgoing Defense Undersecretary Douglas Faith met with the Turkish Foreign Minister in Ankara today and apparently stressed the importance of maintaining the territorial integrity. So the U.S. is not unaware of the nervousness in Turkey.
Yeah, this is really a complication in Turkish-American relations, which is certain to come up when the new Secretary of State arrives in Turkey in a few days. The U.S. And Turkey don't see things in the same way. The U.S. obviously wanted to encourage as much Kurdish as well as Shia participation in order to enhance the credibility of the elections. But from the Turkish point of view, it has increased their fears that the country might be heading towards a breakup in which there might be a Kurdish state, which the Turks have always said that they will oppose.
Well, and Yousef Ibrahim in Dubai, turning to you with almost the same questions. The Sunnis, of course, losing power in Iraq, as we said, they did not vote in numbers yesterday. Saudi Arabia and most of the Gulf kingdoms have significant Shiite minorities. Are the leaders there afraid that a fuse might have been lit that will set off something in their countries by the heavy turnout of Shias?
Well, I'm sure that all countries in this region of the world who have minorities are pretty nervous tonight. Mm. And were very nervous all of Sunday, because this is a democratic election in which clearly the Shiites, by all accounts now, have achieved a 50% majority, if you like, of control of this next government. However, I was never one to believe very strongly. I've covered Iraq too many years to believe that it's the secular impulse of this country is weaker than the religious impulse. And I think many Shiites in Iraq, who are the majority, as you know, Robin, fought in the war against Shiite Iran. And they fought with determination and out of patriotism. Of course, many of others were draftees. But by and large, we never saw during this long 8-year war an inclination by Shiites to split or to be submissive to the Iranians. By the same token, I believe the Turks, as your guest just pointed out, will make absolutely sure that the Kurds aren't going to split up into an independent nation. In other words, the factors for a splitting up are the only people calling for a splitting up are the neocons in Washington, D.C. Mm. But other than this, basically, the Iraqi nation sees itself as a united, multi-ethnic society.
And Yousef Ibrahim, we only have about a minute left, but I want you to share with us a thought you have said in the past in talking about how the elections could change the relationship between Iraq and the U.S. You refer to an Arab proverb which says, witchcraft can turn against its sorcerer. Again, in about a minute. Can you explain that?
Well, I mean, we have gone into this Iraqi misadventure with the idea that first we are going to secure Iraqi oil, which of course we didn't, because there's less Iraqi oil produced today than before. So in a way, it's already turned against us. And secondly, we went in there basically to establish economic and political and military bases to control the rest of the region. And it is entirely possible that a democratically elected government of Iraq, first order of business could very well be to ask the United States to leave, and in which case the question becomes, what do we do? I mean, how do you get out of such an intimate embrace that is softened by total control? When you've come so close, so near to what you wanted to achieve, what will we do when a democratically elected government tells us bye-bye? Mm.
Yousef Ibrahim is managing director of the Strategic Energy Investment Group and a former New York Times and Wall Street Journal correspondent. With his opinion, his outlook for a future in Iraq, we also spoke to Bulent Alireza, the Turkey Project Director at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington, D.C., a story we will continue to look at because it's in this chapter anyway, just starting. Gentlemen, thank you both.
Thank you.
You're listening to Here and Now. Well, the families of some U.S. soldiers are also weighing in today on the Iraqi elections. After the polls closed yesterday, the Boston-based anti-war group Military Families Speak Out did just that, once again calling on President Bush to pull troops out of Iraq before more die. Well, joining us on the line from Philadelphia is Celeste Zapala. Last April, her son Sherwood was killed in an explosion in Iraq. He was the first member of the Pennsylvania Army National Guard to die in combat since World War II. And Celeste, we thank you for joining us to speak again.
Thank you. Glad to be with you.
Because we last spoke with you during the week of the Republican National Convention in New York. You were protesting the war. There were pictures of you in all the papers carrying a large photograph of your son, Sherwood.
Right. And I was actually in Washington with my friends from Military Families Speak Out and Gold Star Families for Peace. And we tried the Pentagon on the day before the election to share our views with Mr. Rumsfeld. But we were turned away.
Yeah. Well, as you probably know, today, the day after the Iraqi elections, there are families of soldiers who died who are seizing onto yesterday's jubilant day as validation, almost, for their loved ones' deaths. And I'm wondering, did yesterday's, you know, images of Iraqi voters in any way change your stand about the war in Iraq and your thoughts about your son fighting in it?
It didn't actually change my point of view. You know, one thing that I think it just pointed out to me that's really important is that if we're ever really going to get to peace, we have to deal in the truth. And as we proceed through this time, I think it's just very, very important to try to make sure that we're looking at truth as opposed to spin and you know, kind of everybody has their own ideological position here. Mm-hmm. So I would like hope to come and look at this with theology.
Mm. What you mean? What it means? What it actually means? Several more days down the road.
Yeah, what it means, but how we got here. Mm-hmm. I think we can't lose sight of the fact that 2 years ago, when the war began, the issue of elections on January 30th, 2005, was not the cause of war. That we were, you know, told the reasons we were told, weapons of mass destruction, the Al-Qaeda ties, and those things have since proved to be untrue, and they still are untrue. And that's really important to keep in mind because we say that we've changed the reason that we're at war fairly frequently. The reason has changed, and now, you know, this last reason, in order to have elections, we've had the elections. But there are 100,000 people plus who are dead who were alive 2 years ago.
That's one estimate. And even the low end of the Iraqi estimate is 20,000.
Right.
That's a lot of people.
It's a lot of people, and many of them are children. And many of them are dead, unfortunately, because of the actions of the coalition. So, again, it's not to say blame. It's to say that's the truth. Mm. It's to say that Fallujah was destroyed in order for people to be able to have an election. And as far as I know, very few people in Fallujah voted, but their city is still destroyed. Yeah. The soldiers who went and died for this and the many who will return broken and maimed, were they given the kind of support that they should have been? Were they there for legitimate reasons to start with? I mean, these are all questions that we really have to look at, because if we take a position as a nation that we are going to walk into countries and say, you will become a democracy because we deem that in our best interest, that price we're going to pay to do that is very high. And is that to be the policy of the United States of America? And if we want freedom, as defined by the president, in other countries, what are we willing to sacrifice? You know, would we stop trade with China? Would we stop buying oil from Saudi Arabia? Would we pay higher taxes?
And, of course, the biggest sacrifice, the one you and your family,
exactly.
your daughter-in-law, your 10-year-old grandson have already made.
Exactly. And for our family and for, you know, 1,331 other families, 1,400, excuse me,
maybe
there is,
too
there is
much.
No going back.
Right.
They're already gone.
Yeah. Celeste, thank you. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, recapping today's top story, the election and violence in Iraq. Election officials predict that final results of the voting there could take up to 10 days. And while turnout in some areas appeared as high as 60%, U.S. officials are warning that Sunni participation appeared considerably lower. Leaders of the United Iraqi Alliance Party of Shia cleric Grand Ayatollah Ali al-Sistani say they expect to win at least 45% of the vote. Meanwhile, the Iraqi election is provoking cautious words of praise from world leaders and U.S. lawmakers. But this morning, House Minority Leader Harry Reid of Nevada called on President Bush to outline an exit strategy for Iraq in Wednesday's State of the Union address. And on the CBS Morning Show, U.S. Ambassador to Iraq John Negroponte expressed some optimism about an Iraqi official's comment that U.S. troops won't be needed in another 18 months.
I see no reason why that can't happen. And we're certainly very committed to that objective, but I'd be reluctant at this stage to try and put a specific time limit on it.
Meanwhile, the violence continues in Iraq. Three U.S. Marines were killed in combat south of Baghdad today, and two Marines and at least 44 Iraqis were killed yesterday. And British officials are not confirming the authenticity of a videotape being aired on Al Jazeera television in which insurgents claim to have shot down a British military plane. The plane crashed north of Baghdad yesterday. It's thought that all 10 people on board were killed. The video shows a hand pressing down on a button, then two missiles being fired, then pictures of wreckage. La Strada, La Dolce Vita, 8.5. Just a few of the films of Italian director Federico Fellini, filled with grotesque clowns, obese ladies of the night, priests and nuns and lovers, almost all underscored by the music of Nino Rota. That's La Strada from the new CD, Fellini Jazz, which pays tribute to Fellini and his longtime musical collaborator, Nino Rota. For almost 30 years, Rota's nostalgic, gentle music accompanied Fellini's often jarring images. The music from the new CD is performed by Italian pianist Enrico Piernunzi with a stellar backup band. And Here Now's jazz aficionado James Isaacs joins us in the studio to tell us more. Hi, James.
How are you, Robin?
I'm fine, because you introduced me to this CD. It is just beautiful.
Yeah, it really is gorgeous, isn't it?
Let's talk more about the composer Nino Rota. We should mention, by the way, because people are probably thinking, well, didn't he write the music for Francis Ford Coppola's The Godfather?
He did. You are correct, ma'am.
That's right. But what about his collaboration with Fellini?
I think it began in the early 1950s. And Nino Rota died in 1979 at age 68, so the collaboration continued through 28 years. Nino Rota, to me, is, I hate to say things like the greatest film composer of all time, but to me, he's the end. I mean, certainly a lot of very talented people have written for films over the years. But Nino Rota, what he had to do might have been the hardest thing, because he had to compose music for some of the most incredible, audacious, original, and phantasmagorically beautiful images ever brought to the screen. These are from Fellini's dreams, a lot of it, you know, the mm-hmm. Jungian self-conscious. Mm-hmm. And he had to evoke Fellini's childhood, which is crucial to so many of Fellini films, going back to his hometown of Rimini by the Adriatic Sea. And he wrote in various moods. Nino Rota could write in that nostalgic vein. He had, at times, his pieces had an almost tinker toy or antic quality about mm-hmm. them. Sometimes his themes are sweepingly beautiful. And then there's the circus and carnival aspect of Nino Rota's work.
Well, let's listen to some of it, because it's true as well that, as you say, he has to, you know, he can't compete with those images, but because who can? So he yes. seems to go in another direction. Let's listen to the track Amor Chord. Am I saying that correct?
Amor Chord.
Correctly.
Which means in Fellini's world, means mm-hmm. I remember. And, of course, in that film, he took us back to the Rimini of the 1930s.
The film came out in 1973. Let's listen first to that soundtrack. And now here's Enrico Piernunzi's updated jazzy version of Amor Chord. Chord from the new CD, Fellini Jazz. Who are we hearing there, James?
We're hearing an international, what Piernunzi called, dream band for him. He has Chris Potter on saxophones. The trumpeter is Kenny Wheeler, born in Canada, living for years in Great Britain. And the American bass drums team, the extraordinary bass drums team of Charlie Hayden and Paul Motion.
The sound of this Amor Chord is so dreamy. What you were talking about, that's, you know, evocative dreaminess.
Someone, not I, once described Nino Rota's music as sad, hurdy-gurdy jazz. Hmm. And that phrase has a certain ring to it, I think. Not necessarily that piece, the way that Piernunzi's quintet interpreted it. But yes, there is a very dreamlike quality to a lot of, because again, we are in Fellini's dream world.
Hmm. Another track on the new disc, La Notte di Cabiria. In English, that's Nights of Cabiria. Film came out in 1957. What are you hearing in this music?
Well, first we're hearing Charlie Hayden's characteristically rich-toned bass, and it leads us into a dance tempo. Dance floors were also important to Fellini's films. Think of Amor Chord. There's a night shot of people dancing at a resort hotel there. There are people dancing in La Dolce Vita, in Juliet of the Spirits. Dancing at night, very important to right. Fellini's imagery.
Well, we want to listen to one more piece while we have you here. Enrico Piernunzi himself wrote this last track in honor of Fellini. It's called Fellini's Waltz.
And again, it is moody, it is lovely, and it evokes its creator or its inspiration, Federico Fellini, born 85 years ago this month, in fact.
Fellini's Waltz, from a CD dedicated to the movie of Fellini's films and the work of Nino Rota. James Isaacs, thank you so much. What a find.
My pleasure. And this album, by the way, Robin, turned up on several 10 best lists of jazz for the year 2004, deservedly so. It's on the CAM, C-A-M Jazz label, Fellini Jazz. Extraordinary stuff.
Here now is jazz aficionado James Isaacs. For more information on Enrico Piernunzi's new CD, Fellini Jazz, check out our website, here-now.org. Here Now is a production of WBUR Boston. A special thanks today to producers Kevin Sullivan and Steph Katsonis for organizing our Iraq coverage. And we'd also like to welcome the listeners of WFDD in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. Welcome aboard. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again, Here and Now.
For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.